start by telling you guys a story that I think conveys a lot of the principles that I use in my work. And this is Mr. Zephaniah Piriseko, and he lives in the driest region of Zimbabwe. And I had the opportunity to meet him in 1995, and he really opened my eyes to what's possible with an integrated holistic system that plants the rain. And he has an interesting story. His family's not originally from Zimbabwe. They moved there from Malawi. And he, as he grew up, became very politically active. As a result of that activism, he was fired from his job by the Rhodesian government and told he'd never work again in any profession. So he had to figure out how to support his family of eight and without a job. So he looked at the only two things that he felt he had to get himself out of this difficult situation. And that was his small family land holding of about 3 hectares. It was extremely eroded, degraded through mismanagement of the land and whatnot, to the point that there's very little that can be grown on it. So that didn't look so helpful. Then he looked to the Bible, as he says, which he uses as his gardening manual, and which I'll explain later. So he actually, in reading the story of Genesis, Adam and Eve, he said, well, this is great. They had everything they needed in the Garden of Eden. So all I need to do is to create my own Garden of Eden. But as he thought about it a little bit more, he thought, oh, wait a minute, they have the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in that region. I don't even have an effective creek. So the first thing I've got to do to create this Garden of Eden is to generate the rivers that can feed that garden. So, and he's actually done that in his own way over a 30-year period. So how did he do it? Well, he really wasn't a gardener or a farmer when he began all this. And so the way he began is the way we all can begin, with long and thoughtful observation. Because we all are born these incredible instruments of observation. So using all the senses of sight, smell, touch, hearing, taste, the feeling in his gut, he would be out every time it was raining, and he would see where does the water gather, infiltrate, and generate life. Then he would try and build on those processes. And where does water too quickly run off, cause erosion and flooding downstream? He'd try and fix that. Here is a look at his land. Now, this is 1995 when I first visited him. It was in the drought, during a severe drought, in the dormant winter season. But what we're looking at here is the hill above his land, and it's so eroded that it's mostly bare bedrock. And as a result, when there would be a storm, the water would flash off the hill so quickly that he would lose much more soil and small livestock, including a lot of chickens and many of the big rains. So that obviously was not working. But then he looked for what was working, and he noticed there would be some areas where the slope's this way. Perpendicular to the slope, there might be some rocks, a branch, or something, a speed hump in the flow that would slow that loss, and then would allow some soil to accumulate. And in that soil, a little more moisture would linger, and sometimes vegetation could even get established. So a sponge started to form on what was otherwise a drain. So he came up with the second principle of the eight principles, which is start at the top of your watershed and work down. Now, all too often, I think we are drawn to start at the bottom because that's where we see the huge volumes of water. But that is not addressing the cause of flooding. The cause of flooding is the excessive loss of water from the high areas. So found that if he would capture the water at the highest point, then overflow the excess rather than all the flow, next point, and have this stepped water harvesting strategy, After a rain, the entire site is hydrated, nothing is flooded. Whereas if we start at the bottom of the watershed, then it's typically more water than we can deal with, and we leave the rest of the site high, dry, and dehydrated. Also building on that, he primarily stores water in the soil, but if using a tank, he'll place that on the highest part of the site near his catchment. So he can use the free power of gravity to direct the water into the tank and then out to more area. Whereas if he put the tank at the bottom, he'll only use gravity for what's below. Okay. Now this is an overview of the site. So we first saw that photograph of the bare bedrock that's draining water quickly into the system. You'll see some rock terrace walls in just a moment, his immigration centers, which I'll explain in a moment, then the family compound, a series of contour swales, rush and pits along the road, and we'll end up down by the reservoirs and wetlands. So the talk will work as the principals do, working from the top down. Okay, so now within the family compound, this photograph is looking up at the hilltop, and you can see a number of these rock walls. So after the long thoughtful observation, seeing what worked and what didn't, he wanting to start at the top, he started to build these rock walls perpendicular to the slope, from the top working down. And after he did this, he stopped losing chickens to big flow events, okay? And the water was more easily managed. Then, when we get to the base of the hill, where the steep slope becomes more gradual, started to dig as well as do the rock walls, because he finally had soil. And what's, I think, great about what he's doing, and I see that's quite universal with this work, is it's a great way to buffer extremes. So the strategies he's using there work in much drier climates and much wetter climates. Because by infiltrating the water from the top all the way to the bottom, we're able to greatly reduce the source of flooding, particularly in wet climates. Simultaneously, by infiltrating the water from the top all the way to the bottom, we're banking or investing more water within the soil, within the landscape, to last us longer through dry periods of drought. Okay. So, he then uses small and simple strategies. So those rock walls were just using rock he already had at hand, was able to build those in just a couple weeks, and had made a huge difference. And the thing about starting with small and simple strategies is a mistake is a learning opportunity, not a catastrophe. Okay, and all that he and his family did on the farm was done on the human scale. So not only was it implemented on the human scale, it can be maintained on the human scale. He doesn't need the importation of outside inputs. The next principle, tied in with that principle here, starting small, is we can also we can have much higher success where we work in areas adjoining runoff from a hardscape surface, be that a roof, a bare earthen area, say in the courtyard area, whatnot, where we have more runoff, because you're able to double, triple, or more your available rainfall. So here, let's say you get 300 millimeters of rain a year on this site. Well, here you'll get 600, because you're getting the 300 millimeters that falls from the sky plus the 300 millimeters that falls on the roof, which is directed to this area. So you're able to double your available rainfall. You include that runoff from the road, you can potentially triple your available rainfall in this zone. Okay? Taking it even further, we can use so-called wastewaters. Shouldn't be such a term as wastewater. So the gray water, say, from the house or in the washing area, instead of just randomly discarding that can be directed to the plants. So your rain garden basins become gray water gardens in times of no rain, or at least when the gray water is deposited there. So then, to add another layer, if we not only plant our rain where we want to plant our trees, but then plant the rain and trees where we need the trees. So here we've got the extra water source to sustain this greater size and diversity of vegetation. But to add another layer, there's also a recognition of the sun, changing sun path in the sky with the seasons. So this is for the northern latitude, but the equator is that way. Okay? So the trees are on the east, the north, sorry, the east, north, and west side. So if in the winter months the sun is lower in the sky and it's always facing, you know, coming from the side of the equator, so this arrangement of trees creates a catcher's mitt that is always open to the winter sun for free heating, you know, lighting, and potentially powering of the home and whatnot, without blocking any of that winter sun. Whereas in the summer, the sun is going to rise here and set here, and it's going to be much higher in the sky. So this then does a much better job of shading and cooling the home in the summer months. So it's this alignment of the trees enables you to get the most heat and light in the winter and the most shading and cooling in summer. And, okay, take out the house and put in a garden. Then this arrangement of trees will also greatly help you with your production, especially if the annuals are in here, the less hardy annuals. They're getting more of the sun they need in the winter months. They're getting more protection in the summer. Okay, so here at the bottom of the hill, Mr. Peary is standing in one of his immigration centers. So this is a reservoir where the steep slope became more gradual, soil starts to accumulate, so he dug down to bedrock a larger structure to grab more water and get it into the soil. So, because as he says, this is my water plantation. I plant the water, I plant the rain. And but what threw me is why he calls this an immigration center. And he said, oh, well, simple. Because when it rains, I stand here on the high point, and I shout out to the rain, "Welcome to my country! Now I will tell you where you will live. In the soil!" Okay? And his neighbors confirms this. He does do this. Okay? And so why does he do this? Because he realized that if he gets the water into the soil, as opposed to letting it travel over the soil, it's much less erosive. Okay? And he's also able to hold on to it for a much longer period because that surface water is much more readily lost to evaporation. The subsurface soil lingers much longer. This is also his rain gauge because he knows if he harvests enough water to fill this two times in a season, he has enough water banked within his soil to last him through a two-year drought. Okay. Now, it's not this reservoir that's enabling him to get through that two-year drought. It's this reservoir plus hundreds of other strategies scattered throughout his land, starting at the top and working down, that are all infiltrating that water, investing that water. Okay. So, I'm now going to give you one of the natural processes or patterns that he recognized that leads to his next principle. So there's something we call an erosion triangle. So you have speed, depth, and volume at each point of the triangle. Anytime you increase either the speed, the depth, or the volume of flowing water, you increase water's ability to carry things, and thus erosion. Anytime you decrease speed, depth, or volume of flowing water, I'm not talking about sitting water, you decrease the water's ability to carry things, and thus can potentially decrease erosion. So, working with that idea leads to the next principle, is to slow, spread, and infiltrate the flow of water. Now, so often, our means of flood management is to concentrate, channelize, and then seal a channel. But that is just increasing speed, oftentimes increases depth, and increases the volume of the water. All the things we don't want to do. So instead of this straight shot of water out of the system, we want something that leads more to a cycle. So this zigzagging, slow it, spread it, sink pattern. So this distance here is far greater than that and allows for more life forms to integrate, intersect, and exchange with that water. Okay? So we get more of a life cycle fed by the water cycle. So an example of that here is at the family home. So the runoff coming off the roof is directed into this tank. The overflow from this tank is then directed to a basin that freely irrigates this grenadilla vine, which then shades and cools the water in the tank while creating an edible windbreak, making for a more pleasant area in the courtyard. So we're getting that multiple use strategies right there. One thing, though, that I loved about so much about this community, as we're here and showing off this tank, he then tells me the story. He said, he asked me if I liked the tank. I said, yeah, I think it's great. He said, yes, well, I like it too, but not as much as I first did. And I said, why is that? And he said, well, he was having a conversation with himself when he had this realization. And he said, ah, Zephaniah, you are such a selfish man. And he said, are you ever going to invite all the neighbors to take of the water within this tank? No, this is for my family and my family only. And so he thought, if this is how I'm investing my energy, then what is happening to my community? And he realized he had to look beyond the selfish needs. And that's when he really started to focus far more on these earthwork strategies, this idea of planting the rain. Because what he still uses his tank, obviously, but the bulk of his efforts are in planting the water in the soil. Because if he plants the water here, not only does it support his family, his livestock, and all, he can utilize the vegetation growing within it, but that water also is able to migrate into the groundwater table and help his neighbors, help the larger community. And in fact, his well levels have all risen, as have those of his adjoining neighbors and those downstream. A lot of times when people hear about this, they're concerned that he's robbing water from those downstream. But he's actually adding more resilience to their water resources. Because in times of abundance, he's banking it in the soil. So it's then available in the times of scarcity. While many more distant people in the community who are not implementing these practices, their wells keep going, dropping. Their well levels keep dropping. And they keep digging their wells deeper because all they're doing is extracting the water. They're never putting any energy into investing that water. Okay. They're letting the rain run off. So here within one of the drainages is a very similar strategy to the One Rock check dams I was mentioning yesterday. This was an eroding gully. Now it's stabilized. He's banking up the sediment here. And then this leads to all those things I was just showing you are all means of slowing, spreading, and sinking the flow of water. Now, the next principle is you always get an overflow and to use that as a resource. So let's just look at a tank. I so often see water tanks designed with no overflow. Well, that's ridiculous because once it fills up, the water is going to find a way out. And it's typically back against the house. So you want your overflow pipe to be the same diameter as the inflow pipe. The same thing applies with your earthworks. You want the overflow point of your basin to be the same capacity as the inflow into the basin. Okay? And the other idea is to use these as resources. So the overflow from the tank is sent to either another tank or an earthwork that can grow a tree to shade and cool the tank. And then this earthwork can overflow to another, and another, and another. And you see this whole layout builds on the principle of slow it, spread it, sink it. Okay? We're getting that whole zigzag thing happening. This is a photograph of some of his fruition pits in 1995 along the dirt road. So what they are is they're a bunch of pits about a meter deep, 2 meters wide and 3 meters long. And why are they called fruition pits? I asked him this, and he plucked some fruit from one of the bushes growing along. He said, here, they grow fruit. And the reason these are here is a number of years before this was taken, the government decided to address the flooding problem and people losing chickens and whatnot in the big flow events. So just off contour, you have the slope going this way. They created a number of drainage swales that would drain the runoff off the site into a centralized drainage way that would shoot the water to the floodplain below. This did address flooding, and that there was much less flooding after this, but it dehydrated the landscape of the area. So Mr. Peary wanted to flip that. So instead of draining the water, he created these pits that slow down, spread out, and infiltrate the water. Okay, and when I visited last January, 19 years later, this is what it looked like. Okay, now this is the wet season as opposed to the dry season when I was previously there, but you can see how much larger and more dense the vegetation is. Now he is only using rainwater to irrigate. Okay, he has shallow hand dug wells, but now he's got to the point that those are for domestic purposes, not irrigation, because he's lifted the water table to the roots of the plants. Another water harvesting strategy here is these contour plantings also create windbreaks, okay, which further reduce water loss to evaporation. So it's very integrated. He's addressing inputting more water while also reducing the loss. Okay, so we were just here along the road. We're now going to move down to the hand-dug wells in the wetland. So, next principle. You want to maximize living and organic ground cover. So, leaves are called leaves because we're supposed to leave them. Okay, so that's in the natural design. So, instead of this scorched earth policy, let's have that organic matter accumulate, the living sponge. It greatly increases the rate at which water infiltrates and decreases the loss to evaporation while feeding the nutrient cycle. Which I really love about this is you can do all kinds of strategies harvesting the water and getting it into the soil, but if you don't have the soil life, you'll never come close to the potential of what that water can do. Because if we get the beneficial bacteria and fungal life forms in there, particularly mycorrhizal fungi, it has branching networks that fuse with the roots of the photosynthesizing plants. And that mycorrhizal fungi spreads out and pulls more water into the roots of the plants, while the plants in return give sugars to the fungi. And you're able, by having that fusion of those two life forms' roots fusing, you're able to increase the root area by hundreds of times. Okay? So, and you won't have that mycorrhizal fungi if you don't have the organic matter in the soil. Okay? So, gotta have that. Alright, so Mr. Peary wants to enhance that living sponge, that organic matter within the soil. So he grows out hundreds of food-bearing trees and shrubs in these thrown-out grain bags. And he gives these plants away to the community free of charge because he wants people to respongify their part of the watershed. And I thought this was great until I learned that 90% of the trees he gives away die. And when I heard that, I asked him, why do you even bother then? And he said, because 10% live, and we're much better off with that 10% than we would be without. Okay, I get that, but why do so many of the plants die? Simple, because everyone loves planting trees, but almost nobody plants the water. And you've got to plant the water, the rain, before you plant the trees. The 10% that lived are those who grew up planting the rain before. Now, that was 19 years ago. Since then, there's been a huge shift in the area. So now most of the people are getting this idea of planting the rain. Next principle. Want to maximize the efficiency of the system by stacking functions, get everything to perform multiple functions. So if we have a tank or a basin harvesting water, we can place those, the tank, the basin, and the tree that shades, on the east or west side of a building, garden, or growing area to shade it from the summer rising and setting sun. Okay? Becomes a passive cooling strategy. We can select a tree not only for food production but wildlife habitat. Both these strategies double as on-site flood control. Okay? And we can all be done in a way that improves the quality of the water and thus the health of those drinking it. So here he is by one of his hand-dug wells down at the bottom of the site. As I mentioned, his well levels are going up. This is the same well 19 years later. 19 years ago, would draw water from the hand-dug wells to give supplemental water in the dry season to his annual plantings between his contour windbreaks. Now, he doesn't have to do that. He's raised the water table so much that there's literally water seeping out of the soil all over. And within his contour swales, he's got water in the wet season there that he can just take a bucket, dip it in. The pump is no longer needed. He's brought the water to the plants. One other quick strategy, as I try and wrap it up here, is he grows numerous crops, great diversity. And as Steve has mentioned, it's a Mayan tradition to grow about a dozen different varieties of corn at once. You put all these different seed in at the beginning of the season. They all have different water tolerances. So it's a wet year, the wetter adapted corns come up. It's a dry year, the drier adapted. Mr. Peary is applying the same strategies, and he saves the seed year after year with open pollinated varieties. So his seed keeps getting better and better adapted to his land and his climate conditions. That's another water harvesting strategy. Okay, bottom of site, he's got wetlands, he's raising fish. Okay, that is his water table. This is the river that he has brought to his land. By planting so much water, by planting more rain than he extracts through his vegetation and his hand-dug wells, the water situation keeps getting better. And this is where the groundwater table surfaces. Okay, and he's able to grow fish. In the driest of times, the reservoirs will dry out. And that's when he has a community fish fry. Okay? And at the very bottom, he's got a lot of bananas growing, high feeders. These are dry farmed bananas. Okay, he's not irrigating these. Okay? So, to wrap it up here, I was blown away by all that he did. I asked him how long this took. He said, well, it took me 30 years. However, his new apprenticeship program with many of the women in the area, they are leapfrogging him, okay? And in 10 years, they've done what he did in 30. At the end of my stay, I told him how bad the water situation was in Tucson. I said, I'm thinking of leaving. I don't want to be part of the problem. And he slapped me on the shoulder and he said, you can't leave. If you run from your problems, you will just plant problems everywhere you go. And he said, you have got to figure out how to change this. And if you can, you will have the ability to plant solutions. And then you can choose wherever you want to live. Because you will plant solutions as opposed to problems. So, thanks so much for that. The feedback loop. I meant to say that it's not a dead-end thing. Like the water cycle, you're meant to cycle through this again and again. So once you've started implementing these strategies, you again run through the principles. Am I starting at the top? Am I slowing, spreading, sinking? Do I have an overflow? To assess, is it working? And if things aren't working, you don't just let it fade out. You interface with it, you fix your mistakes, and you evolve it. Because as it is with the whole life system, whatever doesn't evolve dies. So we need to evolve, as do our systems. Okay, and that's why the feedback.
Yeah, I was just wondering what you're doing in your home in Tucson now, based on Mr. Peary's challenge.
Okay, thank you for that thing. I will show you very quickly. So, that slide's gone. This is what it was like in the neighborhood when I moved there in 1994. Same right of way, this is what it is now. So that is irrigated 100% with rainwater and street runoff in an area just receiving 180 millimeters of rain a year. So not only that, we brought back 24 native bird species that were gone because we've now regrown their habitat. All these plants produce food, medicine, so we looked to the ethnobotanical record and created a public right-of-way food forest. And we've further, just through this research, we've created rain garden zones of just selecting what's your bottom terrace or top planting. So it's very easy for the local nurseries, other people in the community, they create these rain garden shapes to know where to put right plant. It's all just based on observation of what has more water needs tolerance and what has less. And then you put it in the right place. So what I'm trying to get at here is maybe when people are trying to figure this out, like, well, if you create these shapes, how do you know what plant to put where? Well, the answer to that is you just go take a hike. You literally go to the parts of the intact ecosystem and you see what species grow in the low spots, more inundated with water and sediment. You select same species or same plant family, but you're bringing in some climate-appropriate exotics, and put them in the same area. So nature is the encyclopedia. You just learn to read it. with these street-side basins, we've had the University of Arizona come in and study what's going on, and we're cutting the street curb to let street runoff into street-side basins, so the street irrigates the street tree. We found that we can irrigate 400 trees per mile, food-bearing trees per mile, on every neighborhood street, because we get over 1 million gallons of street runoff per mile per year in our desert community. You can do the exact same thing in a climate receiving 5 times the rainfall. Same strategies. The only thing that changes is the plant palette, because the plants in the wetter area are adapted to more rainfall. So the only thing that changed there is the plants. And the tie into the studies by the university, they compared the organically mulched basins along the streets with the vegetation to those with rock mulch. They found those with the organic matter had 10 times the natural bioremediation potential, the natural ability to filter the pollutants coming off the street, than those with just the rock mulch. Because we've got that soil life that's able to interface with what's coming in, buffer it. And last thing I'll just say on here is we've created celebrations. So how do you get this to spread? Okay, the thing I learned from Mr. Peary, he won't tell people what to do. In part because in Zimbabwe he's found there's huge resistance to people telling you what to do. Because there's been so many efforts to show folks what to do. So he just lays out his example. And then anyone who wants to know, he tells them. So that's what we did with this celebration. So we planted over 1,400 native food-bearing trees along our neighborhood streets, irrigated with rainwater. But to show what's possible, we selected these native food-bearing plants that most people have forgotten how to use. So we have these annual festivals where we put a mill on a trailer that we take to different neighborhoods so you can rapidly grind the mesquite pods into flour. You can grind 5 gallons of whole pods into 1 gallon of flour in 5 minutes and sell the resulting 1 gallon of flour for $70. Because it sells for $14 a pound. Because these native foods slow the body's intake of sugar, so they're great for people with hypoglycemia or diabetes. And it tastes delicious. It's naturally sweet. So then we have mesquite pancakes with prickly pear syrup so people can try the food even if they haven't harvested it themselves. They get really excited like this guy. They want to do likewise. So then we have this cookbook we generated showing people how in modern kitchens they can use these traditional native foods and also how to grow it all. So that's really bringing people in. So 10 years ago in my community, when you talked about rainwater harvesting, people didn't know what the hell you're talking about, and it was illegal to cut the curb. Now, not only do you find it in every neighborhood, it's legal, it's incentivized with rebates, and it's mandated by law. Okay, in just 10 years.
Okay. It's been inspiring.